My name's Andre, and I'm an alcoholic. And Virgil, I'd like to thank Virgil for asking me to come down here and speak. I've been down here, this is my third time coming down here. You know, I spoke here when I was 4 or 5, and I just turned 7. I turned 7 on Saturday. So, thank you. I want to say welcome to the newcomers and to 10-day people. You know, I had a sister-in-law in 10-day, I had a brother in 10-day, and you know, I didn't quite make it to 10-day, but I'm glad I'm here, and welcome to all you guys. Gosh, I'm nervous. I just want to say, buckle your seatbelts, because we're going to talk about a lot of stuff tonight, you know. I'm going to take you guys there. I'm going to tell the truth, because it's my only story. You know, I tried, you know how we are with our ego and everything. I tried to tell a story and leave out a few things, and I got confused. So I'm just going to tell you guys how it was. I'm going to share my experience, truth, and hope with you. And I'm a native San Diegan. I was born and raised right here in San Diego, California. And I have a brother a year older than me. His name is Tyrone. And then my little brother's name is Nolan. We're a year apart. And my sister's, she's the oldest. Her name is Penny. And it was okay when we were growing up. You know, my dad worked at General Dynamics for 35 years. My mom worked for the city of San Diego. And my first resentment was when I was a little boy, I found out I didn't have a baby picture, you know. And I used to ask my mother why that happened, and she told me that basically when I was a little baby, she was getting ready to take us to the hospital. One of us were sick. I know Tyrone was little, my sister was little, she was pregnant with Nolan, I was the baby, and she dropped some hot milk on me and it scalded me. So I had to go to the hospital for like 18 months. And then when I got out of the hospital, I turned right back around and went in again because the lady upstairs from our apartment, she used to spit her tobacco out the window when I caught tuberculosis. So I didn't get out of the hospital until I was 3 and a half years old. And that was kind of weird because you guys saw kids. By the time you're 2, you can like talk and walk. And I remember being in that hospital until I was 3, and I loved it. I remember my doctors were white. I remember they would like rub me and give me massages and give me I remember my main doctor, a guy, a white man, he used to read Curious George to me, you know. Then all of a sudden they just up and gave me back to these black people, and I didn't know what to do with myself, you know. And my little days of royalty was over. I had got used to that, you know. I can remember that, you guys. I had got used to that little, you know, Andre, eat your food and go to, you know, give me bedtime stories where I would go to sleep. And now I'm back at home, we having chitlins and hog maws and pig feet. I'm like, you know, I remember that. And for the first 3 years, I also slept in my own bedroom. I used to cry because it was dark in there, you know, and I couldn't sleep with my brothers and sisters for some reason because I guess it was transmittable. Anyway, we moved to the suburbs, you know, everything was going good, and we, you know, it was nice houses out there, and it was an equally balanced neighborhood, black, Filipino, white, Mexican. It was out there it's known as Southeast San Diego, and it was good. And I remember my dad said, whoever gets straight A's can get whatever they want. And wow, I started getting straight A's in the first grade, and I remember I got a puppy. In second grade, I got $50, and in third grade, I asked for a mini bike. And I was the kind of kid that wouldn't let nobody touch my stuff, you know, I didn't want my brothers to touch my mini bike at all. And at that point in my life, you guys, I was 8 years old and things were great. And then a couple things happened to me. You know, the first thing that kind of crushed my soul when I was a little boy is my dad called us all in the mirror. Now, my grandmother is half Indian and my father and my grandfather is black. So my dad is half, you know, he's mixed, half Indian, half black. And so in our culture, we call that having good hair. You know, he got good hair and he got fair skin. And he called all us kids in the mirror and we all got together and me and my dad and my siblings in the mirror. He's like, who's the darkest? Oh, and it was me. In our culture, we're kind of racist too. For some reason, the darker you are, the worse, you know, everybody want to be light-skinned, you know. And we all get in the mirror again for round 2. Who got the whitest nose? Oh, that was me too. I'm like, you know, that was hurting my feelings, you know. Right, well, if you're not the one with the biggest nose, you're laughing. And you know, it's nothing worse than getting laughed at by your brothers and sisters. And round 3 was, who got the biggest lips? And I'm like, holding my lips in, it's not me, you know. I remember I learned about being ugly then. You know, I wasn't beautiful like my sister or good looking or light skinned. And that kind of like crushed my soul a little bit, you know. And then I had a big secret, you guys. I knew as a little boy, and by the time you're in the 8th grade, you're pretty smart. I knew something was wrong with me, you know. And I knew that by when I was watching the Brady Bunch. I was looking at Greg, Peter, and Bobby just a little bit too much, you know. And I kept that. I didn't have a name for it, but I knew not to tell. You know, and I stuffed that within myself. I remember going to church and hearing the preacher preach about Sodom and Gomorrah and men that sleep with men shall go to hell, you know, and I kept that secret, but I never got straight A's again after the third grade. It got worse from there. You know, that self-esteem of mine was just plummeting real quick. You know, and growing up in the house, it was okay, but to make up for that stuff, I was like the super kid, you know? I would like do stuff for, I don't think they want us to take pictures in here. No. I was like the super kid to make up for the stuff that I lacked. You know, I really outdid my brothers and sisters when it came to kissing mom and dad's butt. You know, I would like push the grocery cart when my mom would take us shopping, or I would like be right underneath my father trying to get love, trying to fill that void that I had within myself. I remember the worst day of my life. I was 12 years old and we had just got home from church, and mom made one of them good Sunday dinners, fried chicken, mashed potatoes, green beans, and we was munching. And I was doing my usual thing about being the family snitch. And I said, "Hey, Dad, you know, I saw Tyrone up the street kissing Belinda." And my father like, "Oh, yeah?" And within in a flash, Tyrone said, "Andre, why don't you shut up, you old faggot?" And the whole table got quiet. I mean, that was my first time getting called a fag before. And it's like, I was so embarrassed. You know, I was fighting back the tears, and my father just reached over and pow, he backhanded Tyrone right in the face. He's like, "Nobody calls my son a fag. The next person who calls Andre a faggot, I'm gonna beat your butts from now on." It became a house rule. I'm like, "Yeah, Dad, give me some backup here, you know." You know, I was happy he did that. I didn't want to be gay, and I sure didn't want to be getting called that, but I remember crying that night at my pillow, because I'm like, gee, you know, by my father doing that, that let me know how much he didn't want me. You know, I just wanted to ditch that part of myself. So that's how I actually started developing self-hatred. I hate it. Now, the big nose, big lips, but this part of me, I actually hate it, you know. So by the time I was in junior high school, I'm a mess. You know, and being a teenager with siblings that close, it just looked like Penny, Tyrone, and Nolan's life was taking off. My sister's beautiful. You know, she looked good. And she had her boyfriend, and Tyrone was like the ladies' man. You know, they went to O'Farrell Junior High and Morris High School, and everyone's getting phone calls except me. You know, they're going into teenage and puberty just so natural, and I'm just stuck here at home, and I didn't know what to do with myself. Another thing that we used to do at our house is dance and party. You know, my father, to this day, still smoke weed, and he's 66, but that's cool. We danced in our house, and there was a lot of music, and I just could never, ever participate in that. And he would say, "Come on, Dre, dance," and I just couldn't. I'd be standing there, but my sister Nim, everybody be out there doing their thing. I just couldn't move. I was so awkward and shut down within myself, you know. And I remember that, just always envying them, or sometime my dad could really sing, and he would get us all together and harmonize, and we would be harmonizing, and he's like, "Step back, Andre," you know, because I just couldn't, my voice is flat, you know. Me or my mom can't sing, but my brothers, it just seemed like they always had everything that I wanted, you know. And I remember being the last one in the pool. You know, my father would get us high. You know, we could get high at home, and I wouldn't get high with them guys. For some reason, I just always held on to myself. But it was kind of weird, because all the neighborhood kids would come over to our house, ring their doorbell. You would think they were coming for me, but they'd be like looking for my father, you know, because he was getting them high and everything. So we had the party house in our neighborhood, and I didn't know what I was missing, you guys. You know, and I remember the first time I did actually get high, everything got better. You know, I didn't care. I mean, I remember the first time I got high, I didn't care about their big nose and big lips anymore, you know. And when they put the music on, I was out there trying to do my thing too, because that's what the weed did for me, you know. And I remember taking my first drink with my family, and I was so glad that I had joined the pool. And finally now I was doing something that the rest of them was doing. It's just weird. I remember like sitting high at home watching Wild Kingdom, you know. Ooh, you know, just tripping off of stuff. I remember being at home too. One day that commercial came on with that skillet, and it said, "This is drugs," and they cracked the egg open, and "This is your brain on drugs," and we was all looking at each other like, "They're not talking about us, huh?" You know, it's like, I remember I saw that commercial, and they weren't talking about me. They were talking about worse drug addicts. I don't know what they were talking about. Anyway, right after high school, I knew I was going to General Dynamics, you know. My dad didn't talk to us about college. It wasn't that kind of a house, you know. It was a good home, like I said, we lived in the suburbs, but I could see now that my parents had us so young, they kind of raised us all together. I remember one time, we'd be outside playing tag football in the neighborhood, and we used to see these two gay guys. One of them name was Andre, just like me, and the other guy's name was Joe. And they'd be sashaying back home from wherever they were coming from, and we would like throw rocks at them and call them names, "You faggot!" And throwing rocks at them and stuff like that. And I remember I hated those guys so much, I would be right in the front throwing, "You fucking faggots," and just throwing the rocks at them and stuff and running, because they were bigger than us, you know. And so I remember getting my job at General Dynamics, and that was my first income. You know, and by then I was so awkward, and I was getting high every day, getting high. Grace had just plummeted, and I didn't know what to do with myself. So I got my job, I got my car, and by then I think my brother Tyrone had moved out doing his thing. My sister had got married, even Nolan had his live-in fiance, and I'm still stuck at home. So I went around the corner and I knocked on the door of those very same gay guys used to throw rocks at. He's like, open the door, what do you want? You're that little guy used to throw rocks at us. I'm like, hey, I know you're a fag, I think I'm one, you gotta take me with you. He's like, sure, we'll come pick you up this weekend. And I went home, and you gotta imagine, before then, I was just a regular guy, just like how you see now. I knew nothing about that culture or that lifestyle. You know, and I remember that first weekend they picked me up and we got in the car and they threw me in the back seat. They handed me a malt liquor, old English 800, and we was on our way to the club. And I remember, you guys, right in the back seat of that car, even though they were talking English, I had no idea what they were saying. I had never seen anything like that. It went something like this. Honey child, you better get with the program and get the mustard and catch up because you don't have a film, you know, and you talk too much, you gotta get your hair cut, and you just, oh, you need more princess points, and oh, we'll fix you up in no time. I'm like, what the hell? And you know what? I remember going to that club that first night, and for the first time, unlike the high school prom, I seen men dancing with men. It's like a whole new world. And they said, all right, Andre, we gotta get you, I mean, we gotta make you all over. And it's true, within a month, I was snapping and bobbing and talking just like them. You know, I had my little stuff down and start wearing your pants a little tighter and you have to walk like this. I mean, you know, it was a whole nother culture. And people always ask me, how did I break the news to my mother and father that I was gay? I think I just kind of fell out the closet drunk or something. I don't know. But I don't remember, you know. The sad part about that is the two guys that I hooked up with, now that I know, they were alcoholics just like me and they had low self-esteem. Along with all that stuff I learned from them, they used to take me to sex clubs. I wasn't innocent, I was curious. So I didn't learn anything proper. I learned all my bullshit behavior in the streets. You know, no morals, no scruples, and it was a dangerous life. So I was working at General Dynamics and still living at home, and I was up to about $10 an hour, and that was back in 1981. And I was saving a lot of money because I wasn't paying no rent. And then I started investing most of my check into weed and crystal and selling it at work. So I had money piling up like dirty laundry. And I remember feeling myself at like the age of 21. I'm like, life is good. You know, it don't get no better than this. I would be what they called a functioning alcoholic and a well-groomed sissy. I was so feminine, so flamboyant. You know, I had the nails, the good credit though, the truck, lots of money. I was a little bitch, you know, still living at home. And but that came to an end real quick. Basically, I got fired from General Dynamics. My mother warned me. She said, Andre, you sure ought to be grateful to God for all you got. You got a good job. You're living here at home. You got a nice truck and good credit. Why don't you stop selling them drugs? And don't you hate when moms say stuff like that? Because it always happens. You know, and within a week, I got fired because they had a drug investigation there at the job. And 76 of us got terminated. So I was about 21, 22 years old, and I had a plan. I said, I'll just get another job at Ryan or Roar, you know, another aerospace industry. And I wanted to take some time off. You know, I had a lot of money, and work was getting in the way of my drinking anyway. So I was going to take some time off. And basically what happened is I was getting dressed to go out one night, you know, up in my room partying with the big hair and smoking a joint, changing the record, you know, the whole ritual that we go through and everything. And my mom called me downstairs. She's like, I need you to take $10 out to your brother. I'm like, oh, mom, I don't want to go out there. She said, just take the money. So I jump in my truck and I drive out to East San Diego so I could take my brother $10. And I blow the horn. He doesn't come outside. So I knock on the door. They're like, come in. And I went in there. This is a Friday. I went in there, and it was dark, and it had some candles lit, and him and some guys were sitting around a table. I don't know what they were doing, but they were doing something. It's like, I'm like, oh, what? Hey, man, here's the $10. What y'all doing? You know how we curious, and we'll try anything, you know. He said, man, just try this. I'm like, what is it? He's like, just try it. So I tried it. I don't know if I was doing it right and stuff, you know. And all I know is I didn't lead to that Monday, and by the time Monday came, I had my own crack pipe. You know, that was it. That was it. That was it for me. I mean, if you have a hole in your soul like I do mine, anything will fill the void. You know, anything will fill the void. And the reason I know this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the reason I say that because my whole life took a dive, a big turn. I went through all that little money that was piling up. I went through that like a champ, ruined my credit, lost the truck.
And it got to the point where I started stealing from my parents. They would go to work and I would steal from them, you know. That's sad. I would steal from them and help them look for whatever I had stole, you know. You know how we are. And finally my parents had to put me out. So in 8 months, I'm now living in the streets, downtown San Diego. They dropped me off right around the corner at the rescue mission. And I lived in the street for 2 years and it never occurred to me to come around the corner. I used to see the cop cars and the detox people, but I'm like, look at them poor drunks, you know. I don't know what I was thinking. What I do know is that when crack came to San Diego, and I know when it hit my family, it hit it like an epidemic. It was like wildfire going through some dry brush, because, I mean, my brothers was down here with me, my auntie, my Uncle Mondo, my sister-in-law, Glow, I mean, the whole clan was down here, you know, and that was kind of sad. But I know that I didn't have any control over that. I did crack alcoholically. And I know the feelings I used to dream about my other life, the life that I had when I was functioning and going to parties and had a job and had money. Now, any little piece of money I would get would go to that stuff. And it got to the point where we would go to the blood bank to donate our blood, you know, to get money to smoke crack. And I remember living in the rescue mission, they let you stay there a week at a time, and after that you have to like fend for yourself for 3 weeks, then you can come back. I know one day I was at the blood bank and the lady came and tapped me on my shoulder, and they had these little deals like if you donate 3 times in 1 week and it's 2 pints, you get like an extra $10. I thought they were gonna come tell me I was gonna get the little bonus or something, but she called me in the office and I sat down. She said, "We don't want you to come back anymore." I'm like, "Why not?" She said, "You have the HIV antibodies in your blood and we can't use your blood anymore." I'm like, "What's that?" I didn't know what that was. You know, I had been living in the streets. I didn't have a TV, so I wasn't sure what she was talking about. She said, "Yeah, there's this thing called the AIDS deficiency immune syndrome, and you have the AIDS virus in your blood, so we can't use your blood anymore." I'm like, "But you took my blood last week." I was really concerned about getting me some crack money that day. That was my main concern, was I going to get high or not. I didn't really know what that lady was talking about. And I remember leaving there, and that was like another one of those secrets I had when I was 8 years old. I'm unsure what she was explaining to me, but I'm not going to tell nobody. And I remember my brothers and my friends were saying, "How come you didn't get no money? What they want you in the office for?" And I just made up a little lie. You know, I kept that to myself. I know once a month we would get our general relief checks and our food stamps, you know, and just turn it right over to the crack dealer as soon as you get it, you know. And after that, just get drunk and try to just pass the month. So, and I remember just the hopelessness and the despair that I felt in those days. I was 24 years old in the prime of my life. You know, I should have been doing a lot better than that. We're over at the Neil Good Center where you pick up your mail and you can take a shower or have lunch after St. Vincent de Paul. And they had a big screen TV in there. And I remember just kicking back, watching TV, nothing to do, didn't have no money, didn't have nothing coming. And the news came on. And that was my first time hearing Connie Chung and Dan Rather, trusted people in America, talk about the HIV virus. This is in the 80s. And it was God's way of killing homosexuals. I'm like, holy, oh my God. So I watched that, and that shifted my thinking. You know, at that point, I think I severed my connection with God. Not because I was mad at him, but I was scared. You know, I got raised with the kind of God who's a punishing God, who will do stuff to you. And here is Connie Chung telling me, this is God's way of killing homosexuals. I'm like, oh my God, I got this thing. You know, I needed a drink. You know, so I started stealing liquor at that point, and I was drinking with a different kind of desperation now. You know, I was pissed off. I felt cursed. Have you ever felt cursed? I felt cursed and hunted by God, you know. I remember when I was a little boy, I used to pretend like he loved me anyway. I remember playing in the driveway, playing with myself. I always pretended like God loved me, but now I was sure that he did not. But I came up with a plan. I'm like, I'm only 24. I'll join the Navy. So I went up to MAPS and I signed in. The guy asked me, "Have you ever done drugs before?" I'm like, "No." He's like, "Come on, you can tell us." So I confessed to marijuana, and they said I could be nothing but a chef. I'm like, that's better than living in the streets. Plus, I figured that would get me out of San Diego and on with my life and stuff. So I got in on the 10-day delayed entry program. And I remember calling Mom and Dad, "I'm in the Navy, but they won't take me for 10 days. Can I come home?" And they said, "Sure, come on home." My dad was all proud. He's a military man, too. And on like the 5th day while I was waiting, they called me back down there and they told me the same thing. "Sorry, son, you got that HIV antibodies in your blood and we can't use you on the battlefield in case you need to give another soldier a blood transfusion." So that my little plan went out. So I came back home, I told my mom and dad, "Well, they said they couldn't take me because I was too skinny. Can I still stay here?" And they're like, "No, you gotta go." And they dropped me back off downtown. I was so pissed, you know. So I was back down here, just doing it. I mean, I would get jobs. I remember working at Arby's Roast Beef for like 3 months and just trying to drink and smoke weed and not do any hard drugs. And then I would relapse and lose my little room. Or I remember one time I worked at Ace Parking for 5 months, and I was coming up. I had got a little room over the bar at 15th and Market with the hallway, the bathroom down the hallway, and then I relapsed again. You know, I was doing some things. I was trying to function, but it was just really hard. One day we were over at the General Relief place, and this guy came over. He's like, "Did you guys hear the good news?" We're like, "What's the good news?" "If you go to the Gifford Clinic on Fifth Avenue, you can get SSI for being mentally disabled and chemically dependent." We're like, "No, SSI, $600 a month." He's like, "Yeah, I ain't lying." So we said, "Let's go check it out." So I remember me, Cindy, Bam, and a couple other of my little street friends, we all got our little baskets, and we was pushing them up Fifth Avenue. And the guy said, "Make sure you pretend like you're crazy." So we was rehearsing, you know. Bam said he was going to act like he was seeing things. I was going to act like I was hearing things and stuff. And Cindy said she's going to keep slapping herself, you know. So we was practicing how we were going to act crazy once we got there. We got up there, and sure enough, it was true. You know, you could get it if you were mentally disabled and chemically dependent. So they gave us the clipboards. We fill out the applications. And I remember sitting there. I'm like, I want to go last so I could practice longer, you know, act like I was hearing their voices and stuff. And I prayed, too. I'm like, "Oh, God, you know, I would love to just stay home and get $600 a month and do drugs and drink all day. That would be like the life." So anyway, they were going in and out. They called us in there one at a time. I remember they were staying there like 15, 20 minutes. I remember Bam came out. He's like, "They said they'll call me." And Cindy came out. I'm like, "How'd you do?" She said, "I did my thing." And the lady walked out. She said, "Andre Bryant?" I'm like, I looked up. I saw her. Oh, my gosh, she was beautiful. It was a white lady. Her name is Eve Dreyfus, and she looked like one of them ladies in the Pantene commercial. Just beautiful, long brown hair. It was shiny and clean, and she just looked so clean, you know? And she had all her teeth and everything. I was just like, she looked like an angel to me, you know? I guess I hadn't seen nobody like that. So she's like, "Right this way." She took me in her office, and something came over me once I got in there. I sat down. I'm like, "I can't do this," you know? So I said, "You know what, Eve? Can I call you Eve?" She's like, "Yeah." I said, "I came all the way up here. I was going to pretend to you like I was crazy, but I'm not crazy. I don't even want to waste your time." She said, "Well, Andre, you came all this way. You filled out the paperwork. Let's talk." I'm like, "Sure." So I crossed my leg. And you got to imagine what I look like. You know, I'm still snapping and bobbing, but it's not going on. Trust me. You know, my hair is ratty. I'm sucked up like this. You know, I got fingernails still, but they all chipped off and broken, and I used to carry a purse, too. So I crossed my leg and got my purse on. "What you want to talk about?" You know, so we started talking. She's like, she asked me how much drugs do I do. She asked me about the relationship between me and my father. She asked me, "Why do I talk like that?" I'm like, "Talk like what?" She said, "You know, talk like that." I'm like, "I don't know. That's how all my friends talk." You know, she said, "Well, why do you carry a purse?" I'm like, "You're a man, right?" I'm like, "I'm a man." She said, "Well, why do you?" I'm like, "I don't know. I learned that somewhere in the streets. I don't know why I do some of these things that I do." The thing that was making me nervous is she was just writing her butt off, and like 45 minutes had passed, and I was still in there. And so she asked me, "If I put a line of Ajax on this desk, would you sniff it?" I'm like, "No." She said, "Well, why do you do crystal?" I'm like, "I don't know. I don't know why I do drugs." Now I'm getting frustrated, and I knew I was in there longer than the rest of my friends. I didn't know what to do. So she called in the big guy. So the big guy came in there, and she said, "I think we got a live one here, you know." So I was still in there, you guys, and I guess Eve Dreyfus was in her graduate program to be a psychologist. So she called the main guy in there. He said, "Andre, I'm going to ask you a series of questions." So I said, "Okay, cool." Now that I was getting nervous, I wanted to make sure that I do good on the rest of this interview because I'm not crazy, you know. So he said, "I'm going to name three cities to you in Florida, and we're going to talk about something else for 3 minutes, and I want you to name those cities back." So he said, "Miami, Jacksonville, and Tampa." I'm like, "Got it." We start talking about something else, and 3 minutes later, he said, "Can you please name those three cities back to me again?" And I have forgot the state. I'm like, "Oh, my God." And I got so nervous, you know. He said, "Andre, it was Florida," and he named the three cities back to me. And, you know, I got a little teary-eyed then. I'm like, I used to get straight A's. How can I not get that little stupid question? He said, "Andre, I'm going to ask you one more question." I'm like, "Okay, sir." He said, "Who is the president of the United States?" I said, "It's, to be honest, I didn't even know what year it was, to be honest." You know, I'm like, you know, I knew it wasn't Nixon. I'm like, "Oh, my God." You know.
So needless to say, I was the only one that got put on SSI out of us, and I told the truth. You know, I didn't even make nothing up. And everybody in 10 days, do you guys know who the president is?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so you got me beat, you know. But anyway, I asked my mother to be my payee. You know, if once you get the SSI checks and you do, are you chemically dependent, that means you do have a drug problem. The state won't give you your own check. You need somebody to be your payee and pay your bills for you. And my mom took that job. And we had two different ideas about that check, you guys. She thought the check was to pay the rent and buy food and take care of Andre. And you know what, I already had prayed for what that check was for. You know, so that check would come the third of every month. I'd be right over there. You know, and we would fight. It was so sad. I didn't know that was coming. We fought tooth and nail. And I know some of you guys might relate to whoever the person is that's standing between you and your next high is in trouble. Oh, no. Mama, please. You know. Well, I just give you $20. God damn it, Mom. Month after month, year after year, we went through the same thing every year. Now I know that my mother loves me. She loved me so much, but I didn't care. I need to get high. Don't you understand? I'm dying of AIDS. I played every card I could play, you know, and it was true. I believed it, you know. And this was back in 1986, and they said I would be dead by the year 1990. You know, they said I would be dead. So I ain't got no time to waste. Mom, I don't want to save no money. I don't want a nest egg. I don't even care if you don't pay the rent. I'm used to living in the street. Just give me the checks. And then we fought every year. What happened was I became a ward of the state, and they put me in this little apartment on 53rd and El Cajon. It was a disabled building. You know, it was me and senior citizens and blind people and deaf people, and then it was me. I was there too, you know. And I used to terrorize. I owe them people amends, you know. I used to terrorize them. You know how you are. You've been up for a couple of days. You're playing your music. You're doing crazy things. You're getting paranoid. I mean, it was hell. And, you know, I lived there. I lived there for 4 years. It got to the point where, you know, I would go over there to get my check, cussing at my mother till she would finally wear down and give in, but crazy things would always happen, you know. My dad's not that kind of guy. You're not gonna walk in his house and cuss his wife out without an ass whooping, so I wouldn't even play that. I would say something to my mother that was disrespectful, so my dad would hit me, "See, Mom, if you just give me the money," you know. I played every card. I was used to, like, you know, I'll block a punch or two, just as long as I get that check, and I would love to get drunk, you know. And basically what I did in that apartment while I was a ward in the state, and you got to imagine now, I don't have any friends. I'm not going to parties. I'm drinking at home, alone, by myself, waiting to die from this curse that God gave me. I was pissed. You know, I'm pissed off now. Ain't nothing fun about this type of life. And I would get home, and I had a big old Bible. My mom gave it to me. And I would drink my malt liquor. I've always stuck with Old English. I love my malt liquor. I love the high. I would drink my malt liquor, smoke a joint, do a line, and then I would start looking for loopholes in the Bible so I wouldn't go to hell, you know. I would seriously do that, and sometimes, don't ever do that, you guys. That stuff can flip you out. I remember reading Revelations on, like, my third day up on speed. I'm like, oh, my God, the phone rang. I jump off my skin. You know, I was so paranoid, you know. But I look at that now, you know, I'm 27 years old, supposed to be in the prime of my life, and my main concern is about my soul. Yeah, I'm going to die. The doctors told me, Andre, you're going to die within a year or two. I can accept that, but my soul is what my main concern is. That's why I'm reading this Bible. There's got to be a loophole or something. I'm me. Why do I have to go to hell for eternity? You know, and eternity is a long time. Just think about it. I can say you go to hell for 3 years in a summer. Eternity? You know? So that's why I was doing that, you know, and I ran myself crazy. And I didn't know where to look. I would just be reading it sometime. I saw kind of weird stuff in there. But that was what my life was about. Oh, my God. In 1993, December 1993, I hit my bottom. Well, I was already at a bottom. I hit a bottom and dug a tunnel. But But in 1993, my mom, my social worker, my case manager, and a nurse came to my house, to that little beat-up apartment. And I'm like, come on in, ladies, but you better watch your step, because it looked just like what you imagined. I hope you don't think I still had put together furniture. I had tweaked and turned everything up, pornography everywhere, oil spill. I mean, they came on in there, and what they wanted me to do was pick a hospice, because by now I was weighing 130 pounds, totally suffering from dementia.
dementia is one of those HIV symptoms, but to me, dementia is the same as being up for 4 or 5 days with no food. You know, they look just alike. So I was so pissed off. They, you know, to pick a hospice is a place where you go to die the last couple weeks. And so they had three of them laid out in the little brochures, and I remember just flipping the coffee table over like, you bitches pick one. I ain't picking one. Just come get me when you pick one. And they all left. And I remember just crying that day, you know. So anyway, January, February, and March, those 3 months were pretty amazing because now I have my mother trained. She had just gave up on me after all these years. So the check would get thrown the third. I would go over there and she would hand the whole thing to me. Good luck. That used to kind of scare me a little bit. I mean, I missed a little fighting and stuff, but she's like, good luck, son. And I loved it. Oh, I partied hard. I quit paying the little rent over there. I just, the lights got cut off. I was not functioning, but I was hitting a real bottom right there. And then one day, I said, I'm going to have some fun. I'm going to get high and go to the Saquon Casino. So I took the check, I cashed it, I got a 16th, I got my beer, of course, and I had some weed. I went to Saquon Casino with a friend of mine. And I was sitting there, and I hit a jackpot for $28, and it felt like if you have a time glass and you pull the bottom out and all the sand run out, I'm sitting on that. He's like, oh my God, let's take a look. So he took a look, and I'm telling you guys right now, I was bleeding from every orifice. My teeth would bleed, my gums would bleed because I wasn't eating or taking care of myself. My nose always bled because I was done snorting, you know, and I was bleeding out my backside too from every. I used to hear people say that, and I never thought, how can you let yourself go that far? I wasn't brushing my teeth. I didn't care about none of that. My main job was with Revelations trying to figure out how not to go to hell. That was my main concern, you know. And so they hit the panic button. They like, we got to do surgery on this guy right away. He's in a lot of trouble. And my blood results came back. They were prepping me for surgery. And they said, we can't operate on this guy. You have more drugs and alcohol in your system than you do blood. If we cut you, you'll never heal. And then the doctor said, son, I mean, this man was pleading with me the whole time. But you guys, I was sitting there sober as I am today. My parents was in their hospital room. The nurse was there and the doctor was there. He's like, son, do you have a problem with drugs and alcohol? And nobody had never asked me that before. Out of all the people I met, no one ever asked me that before. I'm like, I don't know. And then my dad jumped to my defense. Oh, no, you see, my son's a little crazy. He's gay and everything, but he don't have a drug problem. I'm like, you know, I'm like, yes, I do. I think I do. He said, do you want some help? I'm like, sure. And he called in a psychologist, not a psychiatrist, but the psychologist. And she walked in the room. She's like, what's going on in here? And everybody started talking at once. My mother started crying. The doctor's explaining. And I'm just sitting there. She's like, quiet. She told everybody to be quiet. You know, she walked right up to me. She said, you ain't nothing but a drug addict and an alcoholic with a story. You either get sober and get these surgeries or you can die. And when she said that, I just lost it. I just started crying too. So now me, I'm crying. My mother's crying and stuff. And my mother, through her tears, says, why is he crying, doctor? What's wrong with him? And the lady says, son, she said, lady, your son just crashed. And I didn't know what that, I never heard that before, but I knew what that meant. You know, I had crashed. I was so done, you know. I got here with so much velocity, I was stuck, you know. And she said, I'll tell you what I want you to do. She said, I want you to go to the Alano Club in Hillcrest. I'm assuming you're gay, right? I'm like, yes, ma'am. I was still crying and stuff, you know. And something about the power in her voice just shot by my brain and hit me right in the heart. She said, I want you to take your butt up to the gay Alano Club in Hillcrest and start going to meetings. You go to those meetings every day and people understand. I'm like, what meetings? She said, AA meetings. I'm like, what's A&A? You know, I don't know. What, you know? She said, you just go up there and understand, and they'll understand. And you see me twice a week. If you can do that and get sober 30 days, we'll do the first surgery on you. Now get the hell out of here. I'm like, oh, can I stay? You know, because for homeless people, or people like that apartment that I had, I used to like going to the hospital. You got the little remote control bed, you got your own TV, you got the food, you know. That reminded me of when I was a little boy. I'm like, let me stay. She's like, get your ass out of here and go to a meeting. And they threw me out, you know. So I thought I was bad enough to stay there, but they didn't let me stay. So I went to my first meeting an hour after I knew the meeting was over. I looked in the schedule and I saw the time. It went from 12 to 1. I didn't go up there to 2 o'clock because I wanted to see what the building was like. I remember sticking my head in there, and there was a guy drying off coffee mugs and hanging them up. It was the Alano Club. And I peeked my head around the corner, and he saw me. You know, he's like, hey, hold on. And he walked around the corner. He's like, do you need a hug? And I'm just standing there. I'm like, well, this dude is weird. And he walked up, and he gave me a hug. And that was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, you're going to be all right. I hadn't even said a word yet, and this man is just having this whole conversation. I'm like, how does he know? He said, let's go to lunch. So he took on free meal. He took me to lunch and everything, and we hung out all day. We hung out all day. He just kept on talking to me, and I understand that now. When you first meet a newcomer, you got to win his confidence by telling your story. And I was hearing his story, and we went to our first meeting that night at 5:45, and he was the main speaker. So I sat in the front row, and I got to hear his whole story then, and somebody held my hand, too. I remember that. I guess I was shaking that bad. And he turned out to be my sponsor, and I lived on his sofa from that day for the next 5 months. Even though I had the rat hole apartment down the street there, I didn't want to go back to that place. And on March 10th is when he actually, it took 3 days, that man actually convinced me to fight for my life. You see, I'm going to die anyway. I already got AIDS. I'm an alcoholic, according to you guys. I'm sick. I'm dying. He's like, Andre, you got to believe in yourself. If you don't fight for your life, nobody will. I'm like, well, I don't want me. You know, I didn't want me. I'm sick of me. He said, you got to try. So March 10th, even though I've been sober since March 4th, that was a little 6 days or so, I decided to fight for my life. I'm like, all right, if I do this, you said, I'm like, okay. So I tried it, you know. And I got that first 30 days, you know, and I had my first surgery. It was so humiliating. I was in the day program at another recovery home, Stepping Stones, as a matter of fact. And I remember how me and all the newcomers would be with each other, you know, in group, calling each other on your shit and all that stuff. I love the confrontation. I used to love to argue because I was angry, you know. And I remember after having that first surgery, having to go back to that group and then sit on a donut. You know, and it was so humiliating. Why don't I like, you know why I got this fucking donut? I was so mad, you know. Nobody asking me no shit like that, you know, and it was weird, you know. And but that was like school for me. I had got so far out of reality, the day program was like going to school for me. And sometimes I would get sent home for being up in somebody's face too much. See, people don't understand that a homosexual can be homophobic. I hated other gay people, and I was in a gay recovery home, so I was on them fags, baby, and don't mention a lesbian, oh boy, you know. So I was crazy though, you guys. See, I was nuts, and sometimes I would get sent home from school, but I got my 60 days sober, and I had the other surgery, and then finally I got 90 days sober, and I was done with those surgeries, and I thought I was cool. I thought I was all better. Even though I managed to stay sober, I guarantee you I did not have a clue. And after 5 months of sobriety, my sponsor said, it's time for you to go into a recovery home. I'm like, but I'm living with you. I'm doing good. Don't make me go. He said, Andre, you're pretty sick. And so I remember I hated his guts, but I went in that recovery home. And I stayed there for 8 months. I learned so much in there. I got to work on myself. I think God blessed me because the SSI paid for my rent. And I stayed there for 8 months. And I was always on restriction. Always on restriction. I got on restriction all the time for lying and gossiping. You know, I just couldn't control myself. And I guess when you're in a community like that, you can't make up lies on people and it's not good to gossip. And I couldn't get that for a long time, so I was always on restriction. But I began to work the steps in there, and I have my sponsor, and them steps saved my life. You know, I had no problem admitting I was powerless and my life was unmanageable. That was easy. But came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore us back to sanity. I first had to admit that I was crazy. You know, and once I could admit that, I moved on to step 3. And I made the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him, and I was stuck. I'm like, I'm going to turn my life over to the same God that's going to kill me, you know? And my sponsor put it so plain, and I got it the first day. He said, Andre, act like you got the power to make your higher power whatever you want your higher power to be. What would you change? Well, first off, I'm not going to hell for eternity. I'm changing that right away. Happy birthday. Happy birthday. I changed that right away. He said, well, continue to work with that. Well, God loves me too, and I can live, and I can do this, and I changed my own concept of my higher power. I didn't have to have the higher power that was going to kill me or punish me. And I got that same higher power today. You know, he grows for me every year, but I was so relieved when I got to start living that. You know, and I wrote that 4-step out. It was long, but it was shallow. You know, I didn't know how to get very deep in those days, you know, and I remember taking my fist out with my sponsor and stuff, and I didn't really feel anything, you guys. I remember just going through the motions, but when I left that recovery home, I had 13 months sober. I wanted to start school when I had 7 months sober, but my sponsor talked me out of it. He's like, Andre, why should you even start school and you have low self-esteem and self-hatred? What the hell are you going to learn in a classroom? He said, you need to work on yourself, get through the steps, and wait till you have a year of sobriety. And then when I got the year of sobriety, I was scared to go back to school. I wanted to get a job so I could like get a car and get another apartment. You know, I was thinking wrong. So the old timers in AA convinced me to go back to City College. So I went to City College. I took the placement test, and I tested out at eighth grade level. I wasn't really paying attention to high school. You guys just heard my story. I wasn't in no learning mood when I was that age, and 18 and 17 and stuff. But I started right there at the bottom. My first year at City College was all remedial. You know, predicates and verbs and division and math and stuff. Just the little baby stuff. And it was cool. You know, I had atrocious writing skills and atrocious talking skills. But I was learning. For the first time, I was learning stuff, you know, in my life. When I was with that sponsor for 5 months, he really saved my life, you guys. He always told me the truth. He made me cry 3 different times, you know. But I'm brutal on my sponsees today, too, because the truth will save your life. The first thing we worked on is, like, he said, Andre, from now on, when you talk to me, you are not allowed to shake your head or snap your fingers. I'm like, that's just the way I talk. He's like, no, honey, you've been lied to. You've been bamboozled and hoodwinked. That is not how you talk. You learned that in the streets. I'm like, I did? He said, and you're not a woman. I don't ever want to see you carrying a purse. You got a big nose and wide lips. You do not make a pretty girl. I'm like, oh, my God. He said, baby, he said, I'm just trying to tell you, you have been fooled. You don't even know who you are. All this and this and this. You just lost, and you need to grab a grip. He said, and the next thing, you finna get you a haircut, because I had the long, straggly stuff. I'm like, I ain't cutting my hair. No, I ain't cutting my hair. I might stop doing this, but I'm not cutting my hair. He's like, you'll cut it. Went downtown, and I got a skin fade, like how I got today, and I've never grown hair back since. That was like the first time I saw my face since I was a boy, you know, and I remember crying that night because just seeing me like this again shook something in me, you know. I'm really grateful to my sponsor for that. You got to imagine, when you are out and out sissy walking around San Diego, you get a lot of reactions, mostly hostile, from a lot of people, and that's over today. You know, I got respect for myself and I get respected. And that just blew me off the water. So now when I do sponsor little gay guys, I'm like, honey, sit down. You know, what do you mean? This is the way I talk. I'm like, nah, you've been hoodwinked. I use the same thing he used on me, you know. They hate that, too. They hate it, you know. But anyway, that really, I'm so glad about that. You know, he told me the truth. He told me the truth. He also taught me that by me fighting for my life, I got to start wanting myself. He said, so you get used to your nose and your skin complexion. You know, you better love, he used to kiss himself. He said, you better start doing, if you don't do that to you, don't expect nobody else to do it for you. And he made it mandatory every birthday to buy myself a gift, and every Christmas buy myself what I want. And I, to this day, I still do that, because nobody can spoil me the way Andre can spoil me. It was such an important lesson because I had low self-esteem and self-hatred. You know, people with low self-esteem don't know they got low self-esteem. Did you know that? You know? People who hate themselves don't realize they hate themselves. They just think that's just the way the world is, and I remember experiencing that. You know, so I was really grateful for my recovery right there. So I did okay at City College, you know. I got straight A's that first year, you know, and I got straight A's in my freshman year at City. I loved it. You know, I felt like I did when I was that little boy. It's like me and God are back together again before I went all crazy and everything, and that was really cool. You know, and I learned a lot of stuff at City College. I was really grateful for my education. I mean, the stuff that I learned in astronomy, I never really knew that. I didn't know, I mean, I knew some of the planets. I didn't know we had like 9 planets. I didn't know any of that stuff. I don't know, like, God, I must have been living under a rock or in a bar, you know. And literally I was smoking rocks and drinking. That's what I did, you know. I'm like, God, I didn't know nothing. But I love the stuff that I learned, or still am learning in school. And I remember being high and hanging out and watching Fame. Fame used to be out, you know, and me and my sister always pretend like we want to be jazz dancers. So I joined the jazz dance club at City College, and that was too much work. But I did get to go and be part of a show. They cast me as Marvin Gaye in one scene and a soldier in another scene, and it was more alcohol. It was more AA members there than my own family, you know. But that was kind of cool, just like waiting for my turn to come out on the stage and doing my little thing and stuff. And I was thinking to myself, this is cool. It's great being sober. You know, and I was happy. I got to my last year at City College, and I wanted to be a school teacher. You know, so I was going to transfer to San Diego State because that's where they train school teachers. And one of my professors who really liked me said, you should apply to the University of San Diego. I'm like, that's that private school, right? He's like, yeah. I'm like, I can't go there. He said, just apply and I'll fill out a recommendation letter for you. So I did. I applied to State and I applied to USD. And sure enough, San Diego State accepted me and they gave me a financial aid package where, you know, I would have to take some loans and they would pay the rest and stuff like that. Then a letter from that private school came, from USD came. And it was a full scholarship to USD. I'm like, oh my God. You know what I did? I took that letter and hid it under my bed because I was too scared to go up there. I'm like, no, you know, it's gonna be hard at that school. I'm gonna go to state with all my other friends. I didn't want to go up there. And one day I was talking to my sponsor almost a month later and it slipped out. What do you mean you got a letter from USD? I'm like, yeah. So I showed it to him. He said, Andre, never make a decision out of fear. You turning down a full ride scholarship because you scared? He said, don't ever make a decision out of fear. Go up there, let it be hard, see you can't do it, and then change schools. I'm like, okay. So I went to USD and God, I fell in love with it. You know, I like it. I'm still there. I'm in my last year. I'm in my teaching credential year. I'm in my fifth year at USD. Got a couple of my classmates here with me today. Thank you guys for coming down and supporting me here. But USD was so nice. I mean, it's a beautiful campus if you haven't been up there before. And well, the reason I like it so much is just the way, I've never really been around that part of society, but these kids got money. You know, nice cars and Beamers and daddy did this and mommy's buying that. I mean, I'd be like right up there trying to blend in with them and stuff, but you know, being myself, and I just think City College was cool, but it's just a little bit too ghetto for me. You know, I don't, you know, I start liking the finer things in life, you know, and up at USD, you got like 10, 12 people in a class, you know, really small classes. Really, it is tough too. You know, I always use those tutorial centers. I mean, the teachers give assignments and some of those kids, but in private schools, they can whip it right out, but not me. I'd be like doing my homework and doing the best I can, but I'm so grateful to be up there. You know, one thing that I got back was my mind. God, I had lost my mind. You heard my story. I had lost my mind. I was so glad when I found it. I don't know when it came back, but God, I was out there, you know. I was out there. I was talking to my father the other week. He was bringing that up because I share my recovery with my parents. And I was showing him my 7-year token. And I remember my dad said, boy, we thought we lost you. I'm like, what you mean? Just trying to see if he can remember the past. He remembered. You remember when you used to do this? I'm like, yeah, I remember that, Dad, you know. So I'm really grateful to God for that. And so I'm in my last year at USD, minding my own business, about to become a teacher. And then my advisor, my counselor at USD says, Andre, I'm going to nominate you for the Bill Gates Millennium Scholarship. I'm like, what's that? And Bill Gates gave $1 billion to the United Negro College Fund, and he had this like little contest. He was going to select 4,000 students in the United States, and 68,000 of us applied. So I wrote an essay, he wrote an essay. I read the essay he wrote about me, and I almost cried. You know, I'm like, God, I have come a long ways, huh? And it was 4 months to find out if you're going to get the scholarship or not. Now, this scholarship is better than the one I got now. This one pays your tuition and fees and your living expenses. And so I remember in June last year, my roommate came in, he's like, guess what I got? I'm like, no, you lying. And I got the envelope and I just ripped it open and it said, congratulations. So now I got a Bill Gates scholarship that's gonna pay for my master's degree. I think that's God telling me to stay in school and work hard. And he sent that first check, it was like $8,000. I'm like, oh my God, you can't win that on no slot machine, you know. So I'm grateful. I'm totally grateful for that. One thing I ran into, you guys, is I work in this, like I say, I didn't get too deep on that first set of steps, but I remember working the steps at 3 years sober, and I had a big problem. I loved AA, I liked AA, but I can't really be happy because I'm still finna die in a year. I'm gonna die of AIDS, right? And my sponsor sat me down and said, Andre, talk to me about your higher power. You know, tell me what you got going on. And I was like, well, I know God is good. He got millions of people sober. He created this program. He can do a lot of things, make the world in 7 days, but he can't handle AIDS. He's like, you need to let your higher power grow. You know, and I remember working on that for like a week, and it finally settled into my heart that God's gonna take care of me. You know, I've been HIV positive since I was 22, and I'm 38. That's 16 years, you know? 16 years. And
I don't know why I got so worried once I got sober. Hell, I was out there for 10 of those 16 years doing crack, crystal, and drinking and drugging. It ain't like I was trying to take care of myself or nothing. I think I was so toxic the virus couldn't really replicate or something. I don't know. But instead of getting on the AIDS medicines, you guys, I just try to take care of myself in a way that I've never taken care of myself before. Every time you see me, you will always see me with a bottle of water. And what I do for myself today is I stay clean and sober, you know, and I put down my Newports. That was hard. At 18 months, I gave up the Newports. I used to love smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, and gossiping. That was my thing when I was new, you know. But I go to the gym now, and even though I be in the mirror curling little tens and everybody laughing, I don't care. I got to start somewhere, you know. And I try to take care of myself because I just don't want to be on those AIDS drugs. You know, I'd just rather do the holistic approach and take care of myself. And so far, I've been totally healthy without being on any of those drugs. And that's a miracle of God working in my life. And I want to tell you about my family. You know, I'm a native San Diego. I'm a brother. I'm an uncle. I'm a son. I'm a cousin. I'm sober, you know. No one else in my family is sober right now. But we get along. At first, we didn't. I used to judge them. And I used to preach to them. I don't do none of that no more. I made amends to all of them. You know, I made amends to my brothers. I made amends to my sisters. And I made amends to my parents. You know, I remember making my amends to my parents. And they just wanted to, like, sweep it under the rug. I'm like, I used to rob you guys. That's a coward robs his parents, you know. And basically, those steps work, you guys. My parents have seen such a change in me. And when I first got sober, naturally, I had crack credit. You know, I used to ride the bus everywhere I went for the first 3 years, and I had a beach cruiser I rode around the neighborhood in. That was humiliating. I was pissed because I often thought of back when I did have a car. And finally, after 3 years of saving up my little financial aid checks, I would put them in the bank because I wanted to get a car. I had enough for a down payment, and I asked my parents to lend me the rest of the money. You know, I asked them on a Monday, and on Wednesday, my dad gave me $10,000. He said, you know what? I don't know what them A&A people was doing, but we trust you today. I know, and I was only 3 years sober. He said, I know you'll pay me back. And I have. I paid him off, as a matter of fact, last month, you know. And with Bill Gates' money, I paid them off, you know. And, we're close today. You know, we share a lot of things. You know, I love my mother and I love my father and I can really appreciate them. I remember when I used to think my mother hated me. I remember accusing her. I was so drunk that day. I'm like, Mom, you hate me because I'm gay. She said, Andre, I hate you because you're a slut. You know, I'm like, oh my God. Big difference, you know. She said, you sleep with anything that moves. I'm like, I didn't know she knew me that well, you know. But that's my life today, you guys. You know, I take care of myself. I love being a sponsor. I still allow myself to be sponsored. And my life is a miracle today. I'm shocked. I just turned 7 and I'm so grateful. I have a lot to be grateful for. I have friends in my life. People like me. When I hear my name now, I don't have to go like that. You know, I always was in trouble, seemed like. You know, I'm really grateful for my higher power and for what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. So just keep on trusting these rooms, you guys. You know, just keep on coming. I didn't think it was going to work for me. I had so many other problems besides alcoholism that I didn't think this would work for me. But to be honest, when I heard I was an alcoholic, I was relieved because I didn't know what was wrong with me. You know, so God is a big part of my life today, and I'm trying to get to know him on a cellular level. Down in my guts, I want to know my higher power more and more, and I keep striving for that. So I want to thank you for letting me speak at your meeting, and may God bless you.